Welcome to the show. This is Brandon Wen, and you're listening to the Understanding Consumer Neuroscience podcast brought to you by the folks at Cloud Army. In this episode, Richard talks to Afric Lennon of Massive Music about the power of sound to influence connections to brand, whether with licensed music in advertising or a unique jingle.
Hi, this is Richard Campbell. Thanks for listening to Understanding Consumer Neuroscience. Today, my guest is Afric Lennon, who is the Director of Research Strategy at Massive Music, which is a great name. What is Massive Music do? Thank you for coming on the show. But what is Massive Music?
Thanks, Richard. great to be here. It is a good name. We get a lot of kind of jokes and slags about our name. You know, are you really that massive? How massive are you? Yeah. So Massive Music, yeah, it was founded over 20 years ago now in Amsterdam by a guy called Hans Brouwer. And we are now a global creative music agency. So we specialize in helping brands find their voice and tell their stories through music and sound. So, you know, everything from developing ownable sonic identities to curating, you know, impactful music strategies for brands, composing music for advertising, product sound development, voice strategy, you know, the entire kind of ecosystem of sound and music when it comes to helping brands be more effective in that space.
I mean, lots of advertising uses licensed music. I always wonder about how they pick the music to license in the first place. I mean, one hand is it even available and does it make financial sense? But associating yourself with a song, not a small thing.
Definitely not a small thing. So there are, of course, some excellent examples of brands licensing hit music and doing that in a really clever, strategic way that fits their brand and that feels really ownable. But sometimes we see cases where brands, you know, quite subjectively is really hooked on something quite subjectively, or the director of the advertisement himself or herself is really kind of hooked on a track and has it on the edit for the entire production process and decides, okay, yeah, this has to be the track that we put on this ad. And often maybe it's not grounded in strategic thought.
Yeah. You know, that whole idea, you're not the customer. And like that seems like the trap you're falling into there.
Absolutely. And oftentimes, you know, that's a big challenge. The people sitting in the boardroom making decisions on music are not the audience.
Well, and the nature of popular music is that it is transient. So, I mean, I get it if you hit it in the window where it's in the gestalt, but it's not going to stay in the gestalt, you know. You know, I'm always going to pick a, you know, McCartney Let It Be that's going to last for centuries. You're probably not going to pick that song. You probably can't afford that song. So you're going to get one that's in the minds for a year or two, and then it's effectively dated.
Totally. And look, it's a really great way of driving attention, driving that fame for an ad. If you want to really kind of capture the zeitgeist and capture your audience and you do that strategically, then absolutely hit licensing can be a really effective way of doing that. But there are considerations, as you mentioned, like, you know, longevity, trends, which are music trends nowadays are moving at fast, you know, really rapid rate.
Wow. Especially when you get into the TikTok land, it's minutes. Like, it's crazy. I don't think you can make material fast enough half the time.
No. And we see that quite often with clients who, you know, want to jump onto a trend on TikTok and they want to license a trending track. And by the time they actually get through the paperwork and we help them through that process.
Right. Make the deal.
A trend has nearly passed, you know, and it's
over. Yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes we do recommend actually thinking about, you know, are there other options on the cards? Is there a way to kind of drive the fame, you know, and achieve the desired effect, but in a more ownable way? You know, can you think about, you know, re-recording a hit track, but with a young up and coming artist, or with an artist that feels more relatable to your audience? Is there a way of tapping into some of those more grassroots artists, potentially saving cost as well?
Sure.
Being able to craft something that feels more like the brand's personality and style rather than just borrowing.
I mean, now you're taking on the production part of it, but I would argue this way. I hire you for. It's like, find me an artist who's willing to do a version of this song that we like. Like, I love that opportunity. That's going to be some time too, but you're kind of creating a unique asset then, at least for a period of time, for as long as that song is relevant.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
That'd be a pretty special thing. Like, I would be excited to have made something like that. Hopefully it also makes a good campaign.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, there's less risk in terms of ownability at mm-hmm. that moment as well. You know, there's always the risk. We have seen it, even a few cases this year where, you know, brands have licensed a hit track, and then less than a week later, an adjacent brand has launched a campaign using the exact same track, and they're both airing on the TV or on radio at the same time. And it's like, how are you going to drive distinctiveness for your brand if you're kind of falling into the sea of sameness?
If you're using a licensable product. And then I think and the other side of this is then you have a crisis around the artist and you don't want to be associated with it anymore.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All of those things play into that. I mean, this is not the only kind of sound that has a role in this, but I think it's something a lot of people relate to in this. When would I license music? What does that shape look like? And I appreciate your insight there. It's like, you know, making a remake is a pretty powerful thing. Gives you a little more control and gets you a double association, because maybe that other artist, you know, represents your brand in a better way and along with this song. So that's really cool. I'm excited about that. An interesting angle on it. Yeah. What about when you're thinking about the sort of brand associations? Of course, the classic one for better or worse is the McDonald's jingle, but I also think about the Intel chime.
Yep.
When I think about the biggest brands, like, I don't immediately have an association with something like Coca-Cola and a sound. There's lots of elements of Coca-Cola that are like definitive branding things, but I don't know that I've ever gotten a nailed a sound other than that old Christmas song, but that's going way back these days.
Yeah.
But how do those things emerge? Is it, do you get into that business of making a jingle? Is it, would you call it a jingle?
So, I mean, yeah, some people like to call it a jingle. Mm-hmm. You know, we use the term sonic logo,
right?
Sonic identity, sonic signature. There's lots of kind of interchangeable terms. Often we joke at the office around, like, you know, we should put out some sort of kind of music and sound Bible or dictionary,
right,
to help people understand the glossary of terms. But yeah, I mean, I think historically the trend in advertising was, you know, creating jingles. You know, for when sonic branding first emerged, jingles were the popular thing.
Going back to the beginning of radio, right? Radio needed financing. Financing came from products. You only had sound to play with.
Yeah,
which also happens to be a very powerful force. You made jingles. That's what they did.
Yeah.
Back when radio was black and white, you know? Yeah,
exactly. And they're a really, really powerful way of kind of driving that instant brand awareness, mental availability. And actually, in the past kind of 5 years, we have seen a bit of a resurgence of the jingle. Mm-hmm. You know, brands like even Just Eat here in the UK, they're like a food delivery brand, have a quite a famous jingle now that's arguably kind of debated as one of the best performing sonic identities out there. And they've kind of even managed to kind of imbue that jingle into culture. They've had, you know, Snoop Dogg and Katy Perry come and kind of do versions of it. And it's become this kind of part of the zeitgeist. So
it's kind of meme-ish now.
It's kind of been memeified. Yeah. And it's So I would say that the main difference between a kind of a jingle and what we would call a sonic logo is the jingle is often including the brand name. It's usually kind of a longer piece.
Right. It's not just sounds, it's also words.
It's words. It's longer. It's usually very musical, very memorable.
It's an earworm.
Earworm, exactly.
But what is branding but getting into someone's mind and having it a positive connection? And we have that with sound all the time, whether or not associated with a product or not. I swear there's certain songs in my life that bring out smells.
Yeah.
Like they were associated with a time in my life where that smell was around. And so I hear that. And I'm like, oh, I smell that thing again. Like,
yeah.
You want to plug into that. There's something very visceral about audio over the more intellectual advertisement that has to be, you know, visually computed, like related to sounds. Plug deeper into your brain. Humans have always, even pre crying out loud, even great apes drum. Like, that's pretty primitive. It's really wired deep in us.
It is. It's very innate. And the way that we consume audio and especially melodic or musical audio mm-hmm. is often very, very implicit and subconscious.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's partly why historically it's been difficult to measure and quantify the impact of music and sound in advertising. Because often the impact is very, you know, subliminal or implicit.
Mm-hmm. And this is where neuroscience comes to play. We're all about the implicit. So sound has a big role to play there.
Absolutely. And so, you know, that's definitely, you know, the path that we're on, at least in terms of the team that I run, is how can we, you know, really get to the heart of how music and sound is influencing mm-hmm. Consumers. And, you know, on a day-to-day basis, we're using, you know, implicit methodologies to assess, you know, the how specific sounds that are being created across the massive music offices, how are they kind of implicitly or subconsciously impacting consumers and target consumers for the brands that we work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got to imagine that's a challenge. Like, come up with 4 jingles, figure out which one is effective. Like, that's an interesting set of tests to run.
It is.
You can't focus group that.
Nope.
You know, that's not, you're trying to get implicit testing done here. This is where, you know, folks like Cloud Army probably come to play, is how do I present a set of tests that get to that implicit behavior?
Totally. Yeah. And I think, yeah, as you just said, quite rightly, it's not something that you can focus group and actually asking people to rationalize why they feel the way, or what they think about music and sound, or why they feel the way they feel,
yeah,
can be a real challenge. Yeah. Because
we already know.
Yeah. And often people find it quite hard to describe.
Why do you like this band? Right.
Like, yeah.
Why do you like this song?
I like them.
Because I do.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so it can be quite hard to rationalize. So I think that's a big reason why, amongst many other reasons, why working with Cloud Army and their implicit methodologies, combining them with our sonic branding and music testing frameworks has been fantastic, because we don't have to ask people to rationalize. No. We can really get to the bottom of the kind of the gut reaction.
We can measure it. But it also clarifies for me, the reason we don't see as much sound in marketing is you have to be on board with neuroscience and the implicit side of marketing to even recognize how valuable sound will be.
Yeah, totally.
So they go together.
Yes. Yeah, they absolutely do. And, you know, I think the whole reason that we set up the research department at Massive Music was because I became and a few colleagues quite frustrated with, you know, we were working with more traditional market research agencies. And yeah, we just became quite frustrated with the lack of focus that was being put on music and sound as part of wider market testing, you know, for advertising, for branding.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, more importantly, the kind of lack of robustness in the measurement frameworks, you know. And we firmly believe that when you're thinking about measuring sound assets, sonic assets, music, voice, you do need to be really nuanced in how you do that and actually the research designs that you put together. And so we didn't feel like we were able to tap into that expertise externally. So we decided to kind of take matters into our own hands.
Nice.
And set up our own kind of internal research department and obviously working with external experts like Cloud Army as well.
Mm-hmm.
To really try and crack the code, you know, really try and uncover the true value of music and sound for the brands that we work with, and help them to dial that up and actually realize the potential of it.
Awesome. And I presume it worked out, right? You guys have got a great array of clients. Like, can you tell me a story of like how you measure that and tweak it? Like, what does a win look like?
Yeah, we're working with a lot of clients.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think one example is a client of ours here in the UK where we work with them on a kind of a 360 partnership basis. So we've not only developed their sonic branding, so their kind of sonic logo that they place at the end of their ads and their long form brand anthem, but we also work with them on campaign music. So finding the right track to license. They recently put out a brand campaign, and we also have developed like music strategy guidelines for their music selection below the line. So it's a kind of a full 360 partnership. And we've partnered with them not only on the creative side, but on the research side the whole way through.
Nice.
Yeah. You know, their big goal is to try and welcome new, younger, more diverse audiences. And I think, yeah, I mean, across the entire scope of work with them, we've been leveraging kind of consumer data and insights. So everything from, you know, measuring and predicting the effectiveness of their sonic identity assets. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the case of this brand, we had three routes, three different kind of sonic logo options, brand track options that we tested. We looked at things like how well were these assets expressing the desired brand positioning, which in this case was a brand who wanted to be perceived as much more modern than what they had been previously, as well as some other brand traits. We also looked at predicting the memorability of the sonic logo itself.
Right. Can people sing it back?
Yeah, can people sing it back? But, you know, actually the kind of implicit exercise for that is really interesting, because it's all about placing the sound, the target sound, in a clutter reel of other quite similar sounds.
Oh, wow.
And asking respondents to pick out which sound they'd heard earlier in the survey. But when we think about the implicit layer on that, we were also capturing not only how accurate were people, but what was the speed of response as well. So how quickly were people able to recall that they had heard that sound, and pretty good proxy for kind of mental availability there as well.
And is the goal to recall the brand? Like, what do you get from a good sound in terms of what it does to the consumer?
So ideally, the sound, you know, I guess a gold standard sonic logo will, you know, instantly trigger the brand, number one.
Yep.
And then with that, carry some of the brand personality, the desired brand personality and positioning. So instantly trigger the brand and express you know, the richness of that brand's desired profile, whether that's, you know, we are a modern you know, eco-friendly and organic brand. And ideally you want the sound to really embody that brand personality.
Right. Get to those phrases, those ideas.
Yeah.
Is there almost a call and response to it? Again, I'm going back to that McDonald's jingle with I'm loving it. Like, you can hear the jingle and half the time the people say the words immediately afterwards, right? With a grin on their face.
Yeah. And actually,
whether they buy the product or not, but the brand association is amazing.
Totally. And actually, you know, the what you pointed out there, the you know, people humming the McDonald's sound with a grin on their face. The grin on their face is another important point, right? You want your sonic identity to trigger a positive emotional response,
right,
that can then be attributed back to your brand. So that would be the third lens, I would say, is, you know, I've heard clients and just industry people in general in the past challenge, you know, does a jingle or a sonic logo need to be appealing? Like, does it need to be, you know, Is it not okay? Is it not good enough if it's just really memorable, but it might, even if it's a little bit annoying? And actually, the evidence that we have seen and that I've seen would say that, yes, actually, it is important for it to be appealing and for it to elicit a positive emotional response, because we know that, you know, positive emotional response is linked and will be linked to building that memorability. So the two things work hand in hand.
Yeah. You want it to be in a positive association. Not all press is necessarily good press here.
Yes.
But memorable is also memorable. And I mean, we know repetition is important in this equation. In fact, in some respects, the same way that a new pop song gets saturated on the airwaves, so to speak, it's these days the airwaves look more like internet connections, is part of pushing it into the gestalt. Like, there is a reason to do that surge with your brand, because it does get cemented, and then you can do a lower level of maintenance after that once folks are on board.
Totally. And actually, like, coming back to McDonald's, they had, that was an incredibly powerful strategy that they came up with, which was to launch their sonic identity, kind of under the radar as part of that, Justin Timberlake track.
Right.
And that was affiliated with that campaign. And what that did was really kind of saturate the market with this song and really build association and positive associations.
Yeah. I wonder if it was an emergent thing that it was just another campaign and it worked so well, they ran with it.
Maybe. It might have been, or it could have been somebody, clever, clever strategist or planner.
Sometimes you want to think it's 4D chess, but I also think recognizing you've got a winner on your hands and taking as far as you can is effective too. I notice that often these sorts of brand sounds and things, they come at the end rather than at the beginning. Like, is that a deliberate strategy or have we tested all those different flavors?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I think, in the past, where we were in a world where TV and long form advertising was king.
Right.
Signing off a piece of advertising with the Sonic logo kind of became the norm. And, I suppose that whole structure was designed to really fit with, TV advertising, radio advertising being the kind of main channels. And I think where we are now in the land of kind of TikTok and social really rapidly becoming, the focus of a lot of brands in terms of their media plans, I actually think that things are shifting a little bit in terms of where should we be placing our branded sound and our branded moments. Because often, especially when you think about platforms like TikTok, it's not that often that somebody will actually watch the entire or listen to the entire ad in full without skimming.
Swiping, going off somewhere else. Yeah.
Swiping forward. So actually, I think things are shifting and we're certainly with some recent clients exploring openers. So sonic openers that are kind of maybe slightly shorter than the full sonic that can really kind of trigger the beginning of an ad and hook people in right from the start, knowing that they may not actually last until the end of the advert.
You know what I think about is like the movie theater, the way they do like the Dolby sound before the show begins.
Yeah.
Kind of setting you up for you're about to have an experience.
Totally.
Now compress that into 30 seconds of TikTok. You've got a second or two to have someone go, oh, this is going to be great because of that opening sound. That's fascinating.
Yeah. And I mean, think about even the likes of Netflix, one of the more famous Sonic logos of the modern day, the Tudum. Mm-hmm. That's also an opener, So
yeah.
Things are definitely changing. We're also seeing and deploying some really interesting Sonic frameworks and kind of Sonic toolkits for brands where it's even more agile than that, in the sense that we're trying to come up with toolkits where brands can actually imbue branded sound even in the middle of an ad. So like, what happens with product sound, right? Those brands who are looking to develop a sonic identity that spans beyond just marketing and into digital apps, even physical products, and how do they show up in advertising? So, some of the brands who've been kind of spearheading this kind of product sound to marketing approach, like include Apple, Skype. I saw a great example about a year ago where Apple closed off the end of their new iPhone ad with the charging sound. So that was the, and I think it was to reinforce the fact that this new iPhone was, had way better battery power than the previous iPhones. But
right.
Playing around with sounds that exist in your own brand ecosystem and looping things like product sounds into marketing can be a really interesting approach as well to kind of imbue that extra sense of your brand within an advert.
Well, as soon as I hear product sound, I think about the sound that a product makes anyway and making that more intentional.
Mm-hmm.
In a past show, we talked about how they deliberately put packaging together so that when you open and close a package, it felt good.
Yeah.
Like it became a signature of the product, that the package itself was quality.
Yeah.
And so the idea that you would tailor the sound of the product to elicit a positive emotion.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Sound of packaging is a whole other,
yeah.
Whole other space that we're not experts in, but I am fascinated by. And again, Apple do quite a lot of work in that space, don't they? Around like even the unpacking, the experience.
The whole UBI. Yeah. How I open a box. The fact that there are popular YouTube videos of opening a box.
Yeah.
Just gives you a sign of how it plugs into some minds, how it affects things, that all of these things play in. I've certainly dealt with in working with advertising firms, you know, they build a mood board. This is how we talk about your brand. This is the colors that we use and the logos that we use and so forth. I presume you do the same thing in sound. It's just trickier to put it in a place that says, this is how it should sound. This is how you open it or how you close or the interstitial, like where that would fit in. I mean, just to make sure folks use it correctly.
Yeah. It's a really fun process. So that does involve mood boarding, but in our case, it's audio mood boarding.
Right.
And yeah, the first kind of phase is very much grounded in research and really understanding the brand, the competitive landscape, the touch points where the sound or sounds might be heard, and really kind of building a picture of how and where the brand in question should be, you know, deploying sound and what should they sound like. And after that phase, we will pool all of those insights into kind of early thinking around creative strategy. And then we'll host what is usually the most fun session of a whole sonic branding project, which is the audio mood board workshop. And we'll start to, we'll have a number of different sonic territories that are usually born from the brand's personality. So the brand's values or, you know, a combination of values, tone of voice, personality traits. And we'll start to build up, you know, different sonic territories. And within those sonic territories, start to trigger different pieces of existing audio. So that could be long form music, short form sounds. And we'll host a very collaborative session where we'll listen to these sounds as objectively as possible and discuss and rate as a group, you know, with the brand and the, you know, usually the agency, whether that sound in question or a piece of music in question feels like a good fit for the brand or not. And, you know, it's really interesting, even though, you know, we're listening to a whole load of different pieces of audio, often by the end of that session, at least if we've done a good job, there's a pretty solid consensus between, you know, stakeholders on the kind of references that feel in the right space. When it comes to kind of, obviously then we would kind of go into our creation phase, our development, working with our composers and talent and testing, of course, understanding how the sounds are impacting consumers. Are they doing the job that they should be doing? In terms of deployment, we do, you know, we always provide kind of guidelines to really help. You know, it's one thing understanding how do I deploy my owned assets like a sonic logo or a piece of brand music. But when you think beyond owned assets into the world of music
licensed
selection
and
licensing, how do you maintain the essence of your brand sound when you're borrowing, you know, when you're using borrowed memory structures, when you're licensing hit music, and how do you keep that strategic as well? So often we'll provide kind of guidelines and reference points on that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah. Well, and timeliness with all of that, especially playing in popular music, it's almost like you only have so much time to study it before you have to act or it becomes irrelevant.
Yeah.
So there's some real pressure there as well. And an interesting challenge all around. I feel like all so often this is an afterthought, that the audio comes later, that often we've built a bunch of assets and that it's, oh, we should also have audio. I just wonder how we change that or if we need to.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely one of the things that, keeps me up at night, gets me up in the morning. Yeah. I think music all too often is an afterthought. Mm-hmm. You're in an edit room obsessing over the color of an actor's jumper or, you know, the art direction. And meanwhile, you haven't had put a second thought to what your track's going to be for your ad. And I do think a big reason for that kind of pertains back to what I was mentioning earlier around music often being very subjective, very tied to,
very personal,
very tied to identity. You know, our music tastes crystallize in the teens, like kind of 14, 15 years old.
Yeah, and follow us for the rest of our lives.
Yeah. So I think music has always been a very, very personal, subjective thing. And that unfortunately makes its way into, you know, marketing decision-making rooms sure. when it shouldn't, because really it should be a strategic asset, just like everything else. I think a lot of, you know, another problem that we've encountered is just that lack of, maybe that lack of substantial evidence to support music's role in driving sales specifically and driving that bottom line. So I do think, you know, some of the research that we're doing currently with independent partners to actually validate music's role in business effects will help to hopefully shift the narrative and start forcing people to consider music earlier in the process. Yeah, I think the more evidence that we build up in terms of music's power to drive success for brands, the more we'll start to see it come earlier in the process, I hope.
For sure. I wonder also, I've seen this in the graphic design side. We've had these conversations where testing has been done with the appropriate demographic, the group they want to approach for their product, to build a set of guidelines before pen was put to paper to say, these are the colors and these are the styles that appeal to this audience, and sort of put a box around the designer to now work within that constraint. What do you find? And often get very creative results. I wonder if we could get that place with sounds, where we already know for the audience we want to approach, these are the sounds that work. Now let's craft something and build it that way.
That's interesting. Yeah.
This test, then develop, then test, as opposed to, which I think is the more common practice, certainly in the advertising space, which is creatives create and then you test it.
Yes.
And hopefully they went down the right path. And I think a lot of sound is developed that way. And the testing comes second, as opposed to, can we do early testing that sets parameters before we create?
I really like that. And it plays into actually some work we're doing at the moment around building, helping brands who maybe either already have developed their own sonic identity assets or for whatever reason, you know, that's not a priority for them. Building music kind of curation guidelines or music strategy guidelines for brands, which is similar to what you're describing, where we'll do some research and come up with some guardrails around the, you know, genres, aesthetics, instrumentations that the brands should be considering.
Sure.
Types of artists that brands should be considering that will help them be distinctive in their category and drive success.
And you do have a whole music industry beside you there, right?
Yeah.
Like the music industry is already saying, hey, here are songs that are being successful in these demographics, which can kind of give you a starting point right off the bat.
Totally.
Like you've got another force working in your favor.
Totally, totally. And I think historically, you know, again, all music decisions, you know, historically have mainly been based on gut. And actually, if we can bring data into the conversation earlier, as you're mentioning, to kind of provide those early guardrails for creatives to then go off and work, you know, I think it could be a really, really positive thing. And we are starting to do a little bit of that and seeing some great results.
Well, and my experience, or what I've seen so far, is when given a bit of a box to live in, they're almost more creative, because they constraints also empower to let's try stuff, as opposed to the blank sheet where you can do anything and you're kind of, you know, it's almost too many choices. I kind of want to constrain the choices to press against those things. So
yeah,
I think the more I could gather, the more things folks would be excited to create on that.
Absolutely. I always love creative constraints, and we always talk about creative constraints at Massive Music as a positive thing.
Yeah.
I think, you know, especially in today's world where there are just endless amounts of potential tracks, artists that you could be syncing, you know, the democratization of music production and where we are.
For sure. The long, long tail we have today.
Yeah. So I think the more that we can provide some creative constraints that allow, you know, hopefully even more creativity in the long run, I think is a really positive thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Very exciting. Afric, it's so much fun to talk to you. This is really bringing to me this idea that sound has a lot more power than we normally think about. In some ways, all best implicit, because it's implicit, it's just something you like. So we don't think about it as a product so much, because it is so inherent to us.
Totally.
That way, if we take it on a little more and make it more part of the practice, we get a lot more power from it.
Hear, hear.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate your insights.
Thanks so much, Richard. Great to be here.
And we'll talk to you next time on Understanding Consumer Neuroscience.